don't you? That Italian who worked in your department.
So this is what it's like, having my own husband sanction my affair. I get out of bed and take Patrick's hand. Let's have a drink. On the way to the kitchen, I still haven't fleshed out the story. Not the whole story, not the end of the story, but I know how it begins. And it might as well begin with the truth. I take out two glasses and pour an inch of neat scotch into Patrick's, a full measure of water into mine.
No grappa tonight?
He says. Everything is about to spill out. That first day in Lorenzo's office with the music box, when I watched his long musician's fingers and imagined them playing over my skin. The oldness I felt seeing Stephen, only a baby yesterday, rush into his teens. Boredom after so many years of the same man, the same sex. Finally, my anger at Patrick's passiveness. The meeting with Lorenzo after bumping into him at Eastern Market. The baby, my new passport. Except, before I talk, I think. I think all of these things, imagining the words bouncing off the tiled walls of our kitchen. In reality, there is no perpetual motion. All energy eventually gets absorbed, morphs into a different shape, changes state. But these words that I'm about to unleash, they'll never be absorbed. Each syllable, each morpheme, each individual sound will bounce and ricochet forever in this house. We'll carry them with us like that cartoon character who's always surrounded by his own dirt cloud. Patrick will feel them prick like invisible, poisonous darts. The way things turn out, I don't have to say anything at all.
I think you should go with him,
Patrick says at last, as if he's seen the whole story in my eyes.
With the Italian.
I should be relieved, I think, that I didn't have to say the words. Instead, I'm sick from having to hear Patrick say them. Sick realizing his knowledge of who I am comes not from prying, but from years of intimacy. His voice is cold. An artificial chill sharpens its edges. I reach out and lay my hand on his arm, and two things happen. His own hand covers mine. He also turns away. We stand there. A middle-aged married couple in a kitchen, a frying pan from dinner soaking in the sink, the coffee maker ready to go into action when morning comes. Everything about this tableau is normal, the simple routine of a life together. Finally, he breaks away. It's nothing, really, only Patrick turning to busy himself by wiping a stray crumb from the counter or by checking the soaking pan. And at the same time, that break is everything. When he turns back to me, the V in his forehead seems deeper, almost branded onto his skin.
Take Sonia,
he says quietly.
I'll stay with the boys and figure out something.
Patrick, I'm... Now it's his turn to console, and the hand he lays on me feels like a weight.
Don't, Jane. I'd rather leave things...
He sighs.
I don't know. I guess I'd rather we not go into it all. It's bad enough knowing, okay?
I have no idea what to say to this, so I push all the pain somewhere dark, to be taken out and dealt with later, to feel the sting on my own in my private time. For now, Patrick doesn't need to know about the baby.
What will you do? I said I'll figure out something.
The V that I didn't think could deepen further does just that. Like what? You know what they're planning, don't you? A new serum. A goddamned water-soluble serum. How long do you think we'll last in Italy, or anywhere, before the whole goddamned world turns pure blue? He doesn't have an answer. But I do. I don't need Patrick and his political insight to tell me what I already know. All those smiles and nods and, how about some coffee, Jean, in Morgan's office aren't fooling me. I'm as disposable as an empty lipstick tube, or I will be the moment we test the new serum. The lab will keep me on, for a while, until we've established a successful track record, until they're sure I'm no longer needed. It will happen like this. I'll be in my office, maybe seated at the desk with no phone, maybe standing at the wall that should have a window but doesn't. Morgan will knock at the door, only a perfunctory little rap, because I can't prevent him from entering, from penetrating my space. My office door is lacking a lock. Dr. McClellan, Morgan will say, possibly stressing the title, either because he's tired of having to use it or because he's relieved he won't have to use it anymore. Would you please come with me? This will not be an invitation. We'll walk down the corridor of offices, Morgan stretching his short legs to keep one pace in front of me. Whether this is a gesture of leadership or whether he doesn't want to look me in the eye, I won't know, but I'll guess it has something to do with both. I'll ask Morgan where we're going. Another meeting? Did he find a flaw in the serum? What I'll want to say, but won't, is, I'm next, aren't I? If I leave now with Lorenzo, I'll become Grazia Francesca Rossi. I'll shop in fruit markets and at butchers, visit my parents, make love to a man who's my husband on paper only. One day, maybe in a few weeks or months, after I've come back from a pleasant walk around the streets of old Rome, I'll have a glass of water in my own kitchen, as I'm doing now. Jackie's words come back to me, trite but true. It all ends, Jeannie, sooner or later. Water, I say to Patrick. He pours me another glass, misunderstanding, but then I've only just figured it out myself. What would you do to get rid of all of them, I say, to go back to the way things were? Again, I hear Jackie. Think about what you need to do to stay free. Patrick swallows the last of his scotch, considers the bottle, and pours another finger. I have to take it from him before whiskey spills all over the counter. That's how badly his normally steady hands are shaking.
Anything, he says after a long gulp. Absolutely anything.
Anything is a funny little word, overused and rarely literal. I'd do anything to get a date with her. I'll pay anything to get front row seats to the concert. Anything you want. I don't need anything. Anything never covers the whole gamut of existence. I lean over the counter, close enough to smell the sweetness of scotch on his breath until our noses are almost touching.
Would you kill?
I say. Patrick doesn't blink. For a moment, I wonder if he's still breathing. He's that still. I have to remind myself of who and what Patrick is. The quiet guy. The one who doesn't want to get involved, who would rather talk theory than practice. The man Jackie called a cerebral pussy all those years ago in our crappy Georgetown flat with the rat-eaten secondhand sofa and the IKEA furniture whose veneer fell off a year after we'd assembled it. Also, he's a man who once swore to tread carefully in matters of life and death, who recited the promise, I must not play God. When he speaks, he says one word.
Yes.
The kitchen, stuffy and still, turns cold. Then he says,
But you know we don't have to.
Exactly, I say. All we need to do is take away their voices. 58. They say there's no rest for the wicked, so neither of us sleeps tonight. Instead, I go back into the rec room and retrieve my folder, the one with the red X I hid from Morgan only 2 days ago, and take it to Patrick's office. He's waiting for me in the dark, but flicks on his desk lamp when I come in. Page by page, Patrick goes through the data. He stops at the section containing formulas written in Lorenzo's neat, continental hand.
You did this?
I shake my head, then realize he can't see me. No, Lorenzo.
Huh.
What? I say, straining to read in the faint light.
It's some kind of beautiful.
I understood, and still understand, little of Lorenzo's work, but Patrick's got the biochemistry background to process it. He reads every notation, every scribbled comment, his lips moving as he goes from page to page. When he reaches the bottom of the fourth sheet, he turns it, laying the paper flat on the others, face down. I'm not quick enough. Patrick's head moves a hair to the left, away from page 5 of Lorenzo's notes, and his eyes settle on the back of the previous page. We work differently, Patrick and I. My desks have always been cluttered with non-necessities. A framed photograph, a pack of gum, hand cream, more pens and pencils than I need. As a consequence, I move through loose paperwork by taking the top sheet and putting it at the back of the stack. Patrick, with a desk as sterile as a hospital floor, lays the stack down and makes two piles, one read, one unread, turning each finished page over and placing it to his left. Which is why I've never seen what Lorenzo wrote on the back of page 4. It looks like a poem, but not a very structured one. The verse is chopped here and there, one word on a line, then a break, then a phrase. The upside-down text is impossible to read from where I sit opposite Patrick, but I make out the title clearly enough. A Gianna. To Gianna. Oh, Patrick says. His Italian is on a par with his Swahili, so I know he won't understand a thing, but there are certain words that will give it all away. Amore. Vita. My name. He takes off his reading glasses and looks across the desk at me. The light from the desk lamp shows every crease on his face.
He's very much in love with you.
Yes.
Is it mutual?
I hesitate, and I suppose that's what gives me away, there in the dark, even though my own face must be nothing more than a vague outline.
All right,
he says.
All right.
As if it were.
How about you put some coffee on, babe?
He says. Sure. I know he needs a minute, maybe several of them. In the kitchen, I measure out 5 scoops of high test, fill the reservoir with water, and watch the coffee maker as it drips black tears into the empty carafe. When it's ready, when I'm ready, I load a tray with mugs and sugar and milk from a carton that is almost full, an awful reminder that Stephen is gone. And I go back into the office. Whether Patrick cried or not, I can't tell. He's all business now, making notes and looking up forgotten stoichiometric symbols in a chemistry text he's opened on the desk.
Well,
I say. He shakes his head.
It looks reversible, even easy, but I can't do it. For one, I don't have a lab. Second, it's been 20 years since I've worked in one. What about your...
He pauses, correcting himself.
What about Lorenzo? It's his brain baby anyway, right?
At the word baby, my coffee goes down the wrong way.
Right.
What about the water solubility problem? Patrick actually beams.
That's the brilliant part. It's already water soluble, at least for our purposes, assuming you don't care about unwanted side effects.
He points to Lorenzo's final work. The cognitive key that, when turned in the lock of cells in the superior temporal gyrus of the brain's left hemisphere, will open the door to repair. Or, in the case of the anti-serum, create a room full of word chaos. I know what Patrick means, and I don't care about whatever ancillary problems might result from systemic application of the drug, not when we're talking about Reverend Carl Corbin's system, or the president's.
Think he can get to it by Monday morning?
Patrick says. That's soon.
That's when the next all-staff meeting is scheduled for Project Wernicke. Your entire building will be at the White House.
What about Reverend Carl? Patrick nods.
Him too.
Okay, I think. Monday. The clock on Patrick's desk glows 6:41. 59. Wicked or not, I sleep, and for 3 sweet, dreamless hours I don't think about the plan, or Patrick, or Lorenzo. I don't think about where Stephen might be, or whether Dell, the mailman turned spy, is sitting in a locked room deciding whether to talk or watch his daughters beg while Thomas works them over. I don't think about Olivia King's burnt stump where her hand used to be, or whether Lynn and Isabel have been caught and are now on their way to a prison. Sleep is a fantastic eraser, as long as it lasts. With nothing but coffee in my stomach, I leave for the lab, Patrick's notes folded up inside the powder compact I keep in my purse. Lorenzo is in his office, making coffee.
Want some?
He says. No way. I can already feel one ulcer burning through my stomach lining. I take out the compact, open it, quickly palm the paper and slide it across his desk. I'll go set things up for Mrs. Ray. Meet me downstairs when you're ready. My own office is empty and dark, exactly the way I left it yesterday. I know Lynn hasn't come back. Worse, I'm sure she's not going to come back. So I have a plan. Hope, not so much. In the elevator, my reflection stares back at me from three sides. From the front, I don't look so bad, a little puffy under the eyes, hair misbehaving as usual, face drawn somewhat from my recent diet of coffee and water. The side views show a different me than I'm accustomed to. I remind myself to straighten my shoulders and pick my chin up. There's no sense in letting Mrs. Ray see me beaten down. She'd only worry. I try sucking in my belly, but it's no use. The irregular bulge under my blouse reminds me I had to leave the top button of my jeans undone. Christ, I hope Patrick didn't notice when he kissed me goodbye this morning. Inside the lab, I say hello to the remaining rodents and rabbits, ignore the freezer where the dozen dead mice wait to be dissected, and prep one of the side rooms for Mrs. Ray. It's sparse and sterile, not exactly what I had in mind for her first moments rejoining the land of language, but I can make it better. I head back into the room of cages and pick a snow-white rabbit from the top row, placing him in a plexiglass cube with air holes high on each side, adding a bed of wood chips, a water tube, and a scattering of food pellets from the storage container. I know they're alfalfa, but they smell like crap. "There you go, Thumper," I tell him. "Got a new friend for you to meet." Morgan walks in.
"What's that, Jean?" he says. "I thought you were finished with the animal tests."
Again, my brain tells my body to stand up straight. "He's for Mrs. Ray. I thought she might like to see something besides a white wall." He shrugs, as if our first subject is nothing more than another lab animal, which I think she is in Morgan's mind. "You coming down for the trial?" I say, carrying Thumper's plastic house closer to the room where I'll inject our first human subject.
"Wouldn't miss it."
I open the refrigerated cabinet, the one Lorenzo stored the vials of our anti-aphasia serum in. He's labeled the second group of vials, the ones that killed the mice, with a bright red X, and segregated them on a different shelf. Where the six glass tubes should be, there's only one. "Did you take these?" I ask Morgan.
"What?"
His eyes move up and to the left as he dodges the question. He turns to leave, and I have an idea. "Morgan, how plugged in are you?" His eyes narrow and his face hardens, suspicious and fearful at the same time. "Oh," I say, forcing a girlish smile, "I was just wondering if you've ever been inside, you know, the White House." Like a game fish after a chum line, he takes the bait I've thrown out and relaxes. "Go on, little fishy," I think. "Go on and grab it. Sink your teeth in."
"As a matter of fact,"
Morgan says and puffs himself up, once again trying to fill more space than he possibly can.
"I'm an invited guest on Monday. All thanks to you, Jean. You're a real team player."
The smile stays plastered on my face, but this time I don't need to force it. "That's just wonderful, Morgan. Really wonderful. Listen, we need to get ready, so..." He cuts me off.
"Absolutely, Jean. Whatever you need. We'll bring Mrs. Ray down when she arrives."
He sticks his index finger into the rabbit's cage, wiggling it.
"Hi there, little bunny."
"Not a good idea, Morgan," I say. "They're territorial."
"Nah, just a cute little bunny rabbit."
His hand shoots back as if he's touched fire.
"Fuck! He bit me!"
It's all I can do to stifle a laugh.
"Fucking beast!"
"Good for only one thing, right?" I say, watching the blood on Morgan's finger bubble. "Hang on, you won't die." While I'm bandaging Morgan's rabbit wound, Lorenzo walks in.
"What happened?"
he says. "Rabbit-inflicted wound," I tell him, pouring more iodine than necessary over the puncture on Morgan's finger. Lorenzo smiles.
"Not the Sylvilegus floridanus, Dr. McClellan. Were they tested for rabies?"
He leans over and inspects the wound, shaking his head.
Could it be bad?
Morgan's face moves through the spectrum, from pink to green to the sickly shade of wallpaper paste. He doesn't see Lorenzo wink at me over his head. You'll be fine, I say, finishing the bandaging job and ushering him out of the lab. See you in an hour or so. Then, turning to Lorenzo, I wonder who's bringing Mrs. Ray in. It won't be Dell, I know that. Sharon is just as unlikely an escort. By now she'll be in custody along with her husband. I picture Poe and his gang of thugs in business suits and black SUVs and dark sunglasses driving up the dirt road to the Ray's farm, tearing through barns and stables until they find Dell's workshop. It's an ugly mental image. So, I say to Lorenzo. He nods.
Biochem lab.
Then, in Italian, he whispers,
I'll need to work through the night and all day tomorrow, but I can do it.
I put Thumper's plexiglass house into the room where Mrs. Ray will be and consider filling Lorenzo in on my early morning activities and conversations. The poem, the defeated but somehow accepting tiredness in Patrick's eyes. Instead, as we cross the white tile of the main lab to the locked door on the other side, I switch gears. Morgan's going to the White House on Monday morning, I say, putting the necessary awe into my voice. Big meeting. Think we'll ever see the inside of that place? Then I add, Patrick will be there. Understanding lights up Lorenzo's face, but he says nothing. I'll tell him the rest once we get inside the biochem lab. Or not. He slides his key card into the slot, and this time, instead of the light turning green, instead of the soft ping and click of electronics and mechanics, there's a sharp buzz and a flashing red light. I try mine with the same result. We're locked out. 60. I'm on the intercom to Morgan before Lorenzo can stop me. We need access to the biochem lab, I say, then hearing the fury in my own voice. There must be a mistake, Morgan. Can you? He cuts me off. No, you don't. And no, I can't. What? The word comes out as if I've just spit, which is exactly what I'd like to do, right in Morgan's rat-like face.
Jean, Jean, Jean,
he says, and I prepare myself for his impatient kindergarten teacher lecture.
If the Ray woman's trial is successful, you're done here. You and Lorenzo have nothing more to work on.
Oh, yes, we do, I think. And Lynn? I say, fishing. Or is Lynn not on the team anymore?
Of course, I meant you and Lorenzo and Lynn, the whole team.
Lorenzo, who's been listening in, his head so close to mine I can feel the bristle of unshaved cheek, interrupts.
Morgan, we need the lab for propagation. We've got a limited quantity of serum, you know that.
Silence. Then,
that's being dealt with. By another team. The propagation, I mean.
Right, and the reverse engineering. The gold team must be as busy as a hive today. I nod to Lorenzo and point toward the storage refrigerator behind him, then wedge the intercom's handset between my ear and shoulder, leaving my hands free. I hold up six fingers, then only one.
Nice,
Lorenzo says after opening the refrigerator and counting the vials. He mouths,
Morgan?
I shrug as if to say, who else?
Jean, did you hear me? I said Mrs. Ray is here. We're bringing her down in a few minutes.
Yeah, Morgan, I heard you. And I hang up. Last night, or this morning, I asked Patrick about the viability of reversing the serum, turning our cure into a weapon using only the product.
It's doable without Lorenzo's formulas, he said in the darkness of his study. If they have the right type of chemists on the gold team.
He looked over the notes, this time using my method, top page to bottom, instead of turning the pages over and laying them to the side as he finished. Of course, he didn't want to see the poem again. Getting slapped in the face once was enough.
Definitely doable, but slower. See, they need to break down the product and...
Everything else Patrick said was a blur. I'm no chemist. Lorenzo, I say, taking the single vial of serum from the fridge and two packets of sterile syringes from the cabinet next to it. I pretend to study them and lower my voice to the barest of whispers.
The notes I have are the only copies, right?
He slaps the counter with the palm of his hand and sprints toward the rodent and rabbit room. I hear the main door of the lab hiss open and closed. 61. Lynn, even absent, guides me through the setup. Her notes are pristine, as detailed as a set of blueprints. If she were here, I wouldn't be handling the injection, and that injection wouldn't deliver a concoction of proteins and stem cells into Mrs. Ray's bloodstream. Lynn would take care of that, through a strategically placed borehole in our subject's skull, not an operation I was keen on trying myself. As if she anticipated her own sudden disappearance, Lynn assembled two separate procedures. I put the instructions for direct-to-brain delivery aside, wincing at the photographs of skulls and immobilizing frames and boring instruments, wondering what sort of nutcase one had to be to try this on himself. Or herself, I think, remembering the woman who took an electric drill to her own head sometime in the 1970s. She said it opened up her mind. Right. What I'm about to do is easier, since Mrs. Ray will have already been prepped with a catheter before leaving the nursing home where she now spends her days. I suppose she'll be returning there once the trial is over. She has no home to go to, with Dell out of the picture. Some favor I'm doing her, I think, and wonder if the old woman who planted my gardens might be better off in her current state. At least she won't understand what's going on when some bureaucrat in a suit informs her what's happened to her son and daughter-in-law, and her grandchildren. Lorenzo's offer is still on the table, but how can I even debate it with myself? What brand of monster would hop on a flight with a forged passport and leave four children behind? Then again, how fucked up would I have to be to stay, knowing exactly what will become of this next baby? Super fucked up, I decide. Either way, I lose. The main door hisses open and shut again, and footsteps echo through the empty lab. The mice squeak at the intrusion into their space. Enzo? But it isn't Lorenzo. The intruder is Morgan, and behind him, a young man dressed in orderly's scrubs wheels Mrs. Ray into the room. She looks much older than the last time I saw her. Stephen, now on a fool's mission to find his girl, was still struggling with multiplication tables when Delilah Ray came to the house with her plans for my garden. America's first black president had taken the keys, and Mrs. Ray was in high form, all talk of politics and hope, and how it was about time, darlin', this country got on the right track. She always called me darlin', in that sweet southern way of hers. Until she had the stroke. It happened not long before the hopeful president handed over his keys to a new man, the one Mrs. Ray would never refer to as a darlin', or hopeful, or charismatic, or anything else on the positive end of her rich vocabulary spectrum. When I called that day to ask about a problem with one of my rose bushes, her son answered and gave me the news. I can still hear the hope in his voice, feel the breathless, wordless optimism hanging between us like a storm cloud as I outlined my research.
What if it doesn't work? Dell said. What if my mother still speaks in riddles and non-words?
Then we'll try again, I said, and we'll keep trying. That was when he mentioned money. I told him not to even think about it. There would be no fee. I turned to my first human subject now, an old woman in a wheelchair, gazing around the white emptiness of the lab. How are you, Mrs. Ray? I say, knowing she won't interpret this as anything but a string of unfamiliar words. Delilah Ray, the botanist who designed my garden and talked politics and pie recipes, looks up at me through a veil of confusion and non-comprehension.
Fine twinkles today. Cookie for your thoughts, and when the Red Sox gossiping and galloping, I don't know, there's going to be hypertension.
Her speech is fluid and unencumbered and meaningless. I hope to change this. Looking back, I can never recall whether I expected success or failure, but in my dreams, I've always imagined the old woman's first words that would hold real meaning since her stroke. As I fill the syringe with fluid from the single vial, I realize my hands are shaking.
Here, let me.
It's Lorenzo. I was so lost in my memories I didn't hear him come into the lab. He takes the vial and syringe from me and expertly draws out the prescribed quantity of serum, according to Lynn's instructions. He taps it twice with the knuckle of his first finger and holds it up to the light. I look a question at him. Lorenzo nods to Morgan, signaling that it's time. As the orderly wheels Mrs. Ray into the room I've prepared, Lorenzo takes my arm, and he shakes his head no. The gold team, whoever they are, have the serum and the formulas.
All right, I say. Let's get to it. I have tickets,
he says quietly.
Tickets for what?
Morgan has poked his nose out of Mrs. Ray's room.
For the symphony next weekend,
Lorenzo lies.
Beethoven, you know. Hard to get if you're not on the A-list.
Well, I don't care about your A-list or your symphony, Morgan says. We're waiting in here and I have other meetings.
Sure you do, Morgan. Big wheel like you,
Lorenzo says. He's almost snarling. I put away thoughts of flight, at least for now, and walk into the sterile room with Lorenzo close behind me. Mrs. Ray is regarding Thumper with a quizzical look, as if she's remembering something.
Beauty is as beauty does in crops of corn. So silly, she says.
The orderly reaches down and gives her a reassuring pat on the back. Morgan smirks. Lorenzo and I exchange a look. I know what he's thinking. An entire city, country, continent of this. A modern-day Tower of Babel, except instead of being caused by some invisible deity, the confusion will happen at the hand of a very visible man, one who enjoys being on television and who has tasted the power that comes with millions of blind followers but still wants more. One who has no idea of the hell he's about to unleash. Reverend Carl Corbin must be insane, truly insane. Has he thought ahead to the inevitable outcome? Does he realize the havoc, not only in Europe, but everywhere, his plot will wreak? Supply chains, gone. Banks and stock markets, gone. Mass transit, any transit really, other than foot traffic and the occasional horse, gone. Factories, gone. Within weeks, most of the world's population will die of hunger or dehydration or violence. The ones who are left will be eking life out in a twisted little house on the prairie existence, building from the ground up, one haystack and corn silo at a time. Maybe that's what he wants, though. Maybe Carl Corbin and his pure blue followers aren't as insane as all that. They certainly aren't too insane to wield the strings from which President Myers dances.
We're ready, Jean,
Lorenzo says, holding out the syringe.
You do the honors.
I take it from him, inspect the fluid for any remaining bubbles of air, such a necessary substance, unless it happens to work its way into Mrs. Ray's cerebral circulation, and remove the plastic cap. Morgan licks his lips as I insert the needle into the catheter, holding my breath, and steadily depress the plunger.
You'll be fine, Mrs. Ray, I say.
The room has become a sauna, heavy and hot and airless. Beside me, Lorenzo starts a stopwatch, and we wait, all eyes on the woman in the wheelchair. It seems hours, but I'm told only 10 minutes have passed when Delilah Ray checks the catheter, rubs at a spot on the left side of her graying head, and turns to the plexiglass box holding Thumper.
What a lovely rabbit that is, she says. A cottontail. Used to have a whole warren full of them when I was a girl.
The air in the room clears like the tropics after a monsoon. 62. I feel like celebrating, or dancing, or turning cartwheels down the empty hall of the lab. I feel like champagne and chocolate and fireworks. I feel, just a little, like a god. Also, I feel my life may be over. Morgan leaves us after a brief conversation on his phone, most of which involves references to my team and my project and my work. He's still smirking as he walks past us and out the lab's main doors, calling for the orderly to pick up his pace and take Mrs. Ray back to her nursing home. Morgan, of course, has more work to do. So, I say, turning to Lorenzo, I guess that's it.
Not necessarily.
His eyes move to the refrigerated cabinet where 6 vials, all labeled with the red X of death, remain.
No way, I whisper.
It's the only way,
he says, and the very words I spoke to Patrick last night play over in my head, a broken record of, would you kill?
We'll never get them out of here.
He opens the refrigerator door and slides out the tray with the deadly neuroproteins, the poison that, even in the smallest of quantities, killed a dozen mice.
We only need one, Jana.
I check the clock on the lab wall. Both hands point straight up. When I came in this morning, Sergeant Petrosky was on duty at the security station. He yawned, said hello, and yawned again. If he was up all night, the only ally I have in this building will be at home, sleeping off a graveyard shift.
All right, on to Plan B.
Except I don't have a Plan B. Or maybe I do. There's a closet-sized washroom off the main lab, nothing more than a 5x5 square of tile with a toilet, a sink, and one of those hand dryers that roar like twin jet engines and make the skin on your hands stretch into a taut, science fiction-y special effect. I lean over the fridge, pluck one of the vials from its tray, and wedge it into the front of my bra. Then take a single surgical glove, the kind with no powder, from the dispenser on the counter. Be right back, I say, blowing air into the glove. After considering what I'm about to do, I take 2 more and head in the direction of the washroom. Lorenzo raises an eyebrow. 6 vials, right? I say, and hear a cabinet opening behind me, followed by the running of water from the lab sink's tap. The soldiers never check us over thoroughly when we enter the building in the morning or when we leave it at night. They're men, after all. Perhaps, after a year of not having to worry about mouthy women and girl power and female wiles, perhaps after so long in their men's world, they've forgotten our secrets, our ways of hiding small cylindrical objects. Perhaps, after all this time of our silence, even their suspicions have lapsed into nothing. I check the vial stopper 5 times before I'm satisfied it's secure, then fit the tube inside the latex finger of one glove. Tie a knot before trimming the excess bulk, and repeat the process with the next 2 gloves. The end result is a wad of blue latex, not exactly cylindrical anymore and not small, but likely leak-proof. What the hell, I think. I've had 4 baby heads the size of Nerf balls pass through me. I can stand some minor discomfort for the next hour. Once I've straightened myself out and blown my hands dry, I rejoin Lorenzo in the lab. He gives me a single warning look, and Poe steps toward me. For some reason, he seems even larger when I'm standing up.
Problem, Dr. McClellan?
Poe says.
Only if you lower my daily quota on bathroom visits.
Poe has no response to this, but after checking each room in the lab and stopping to regard Thumper in his plexiglass cage, he turns to us.
Follow me.
We're not done here, I say. Are we, Enzo? The look I give him is hard and unmistakably a different question.
We're done, he says.
Poe snoops around for another 5 minutes, and I hold my breath as he opens the storage refrigerator and spends more time than I think is necessary counting the vials. Then he leads us through the lab doors and down the corridor and presses the up button on the elevator.
Key cards, please.
He holds out 1 meaty hand. That's it, I say, pulling the lanyard over my head. It gets stuck in my hair, and Poe reaches over to untangle it. His hand brushes my temple and sends a shiver through me. He's ice cold. I think of Dell again, and Sharon, and their 3 girls. For the oddest of reasons, I wonder who's feeding the animals on the Ray's farm. Once, when he was more child than man, Stephen asked me if animals had language. No, I said. Do they think? No. He'd read a book about bees in school and showed it to me one afternoon in the kitchen. That was when Stephen, not Sonia, wanted hot cocoa every day at 4 o'clock. It says that bees can go find pollen and then come back to the hive and tell the other bees where the pollen is. He read part of the chapter aloud. The bee dance is like a language, so there. I checked over the book, examining the bio of one of the authors. She was an apiarist with a long line of credentials, none of which had much to do with linguistics. So they're nothing, I said. Yes, the bees dance. They do a little, hey guys, here's the good pollen sort of a jig. But that's it, kiddo. Tie their wings down and make them walk back to the hive and they're giving directions to the nearest rock. What bees have is communication, and only a specialized form of it. That's not language. Only humans have language.
What about Coco the gorilla?
His book was co-written by a team of animal experts. Coco's terrific, and she knows a few hundred signs, but she still doesn't do what your brothers can. Sam and Leo were 4 at the time. Coco was 45. Stephen took his textbook and went to his room to sulk. Another bubble burst, I thought. It's pleasant to imagine our 4 and 2-legged friends have a linguistic mechanism of their own. Maybe that's why people keep searching for proof. But it isn't true. Here in the elevator, I find myself wishing it were.
That's it, Poe says when we reach the first floor. You can collect your laptops. They've been scrubbed.
Lorenzo and I collect our bags. He's allowed to take his coffee maker, but nothing else, from his office before Poe closes the door and leads us out to security. Everything is the same. 2 soldiers, 1 x-ray machine for our bags, and 0 smiles now that Sergeant Petrosky is off duty. One by one, we're frisked, our pockets are searched, and the soldier working me over spends an unpleasant amount of extra time on my crotch and cleavage. From the look on Lorenzo's face, he's getting the same treatment down below. Every possibility runs through my mind now. Full body search, anonymous hands, only obeying orders, ma'am, roaming over me, sliding into places they don't belong, finding the latex-wrapped vial. What's this, Jean? Morgan will say. I see myself on 1,000 television screens, a surprise performance interrupting a news segment, a documentary on Bengal tigers, a cartoon. Me, next to Reverend Carl as he reads off another chapter in verse, as camera flashes blind me, as my scalp burns from the sting of a sloppy razor job. I see the horror in Patrick's eyes as he's bussed to Fort Meade and forced to stand at attention while my blood mixes with the remains of Jimbo and Dell and Sharon and God knows who else. Maybe my own son. Instead, we're shown the door. Nothing like a little, here's your hat, what's your hurry, I say when we're out in the late afternoon light. Poe watches us walk toward our cars. If he hears what I've said, I don't know. But he calls out after us,
leave, and don't come back here.
He disappears inside the building, hands stuffed into his pockets. I think I see him sigh. 63. I use Lorenzo's phone to call Patrick and tell him I'm on my way home. Lorenzo, of course, still has a cell phone. I don't. You would if you were in Italy, kiddo, I tell myself, but push the thought out of my head. I can't think about that right now. I can't think about anything except getting into my car and getting this poison out of my body.
So,
Lorenzo says, taking hold of my left wrist, stroking the old burn with his thumb.
I have to get out, you know, while there's still time.
I know. He breaks away and opens the passenger door of his car. From the glove compartment, he removes a slim envelope and hands it to me.
This is for you.
It feels like a passport and something else, something flat and hard. A smartphone is my best guess.
Give me a second,
I say. I pull the door closed and hitch up my skirt, ridding myself of the latex-wrapped package and stowing it in one of Sonia's pastel sippy cups. She's outgrown them, but juice in a plastic cup has always been a happy alternative to juice all over the Honda's windshield. The lid snaps closed, and I breathe easily again.
Jean!
Morgan is running toward us, arms out, frantic. The soldier behind him takes measured strides, arms relaxed, except for the slight crook at the left elbow and the splayed hand poised too close to his service weapon. He's a picture of military discipline. It's a good thing for Morgan he wasn't around during the draft era. The kid would probably die in his first foxhole. If, that is, his platoon didn't get to him first. Lorenzo's envelope goes under my car seat as if someone else's hand is obeying instructions from a foreign brain. I don't think about it, only reach down automatically, sliding the evidence out of sight before Morgan, now at my window, catches me with the passport of Lorenzo's dead wife. I don't know what the penalty is for carrying forged identification, and I'm not at all eager to find out. The serum, unfortunately, has to stay where it is for a while longer.
We need you back inside, Morgan says.
Why? I say, starting the Honda's engine and faking ignorance. If I forgot something, I'll get it tomorrow. I haven't seen my kids all weekend. Only then does it occur to me why I'm wanted back inside. The project's over, and so is my reprieve from silence. Morgan reaches into my window with one small pink hand. At the same time, Lorenzo steps in between us.
Let her go,
Lorenzo says. The soldier hasn't moved, except to draw his service weapon. I know shit about guns, but I know enough to understand where this could end up if I don't take some control, fast. Enzo, you need to leave, I say, seeing in his eyes that he's got zero intention of moving from his position between the steadiness of that steel barrel and my open window. He proves my point.
Neither of you is leaving, Morgan says.
The clock on my dashboard takes an eternity to turn from 1:36 to 1:37. Okay. I take my hands off the steering wheel. Okay, I'm turning the car off. With my left hand still in the air, I kill the Honda's engine with my right. Okay, can I get out now? Morgan, who has squirmed as far from the line of fire as possible, signals to the soldier, and the gun moves down slightly. It does not go back into its holster as I open the car door. Morgan leads our four-person parade across the parking lot. I take little comfort in knowing Lorenzo is a few paces behind me, a vulnerable shield between several rounds of ammunition and my own body. We're waved through the security checkpoint and herded into an elevator. This time, instead of hitting the button for the basement floor, Morgan inserts his key card and presses SB, sub-basement. I meet Lorenzo's eyes, my own filled with questions, mixed with fear, mixed with defeat, as the door slides open. He puts a hand on the small of my back, steadying me, and we follow Morgan out the door, the soldier still and quiet, but very definitely present behind us. 64. If our own lab and office floors were lonely tombs, the sub-basement is a buzzing hive of activity. Cubicles housing two men each sit crammed side by side, their flimsy shoulder-height walls allowing no privacy, only constant observation by the uniformed guards patrolling the corridors. I count 12 of them, each as devoid of any outward signs of jocularity as the man now walking behind me, close enough for me to get a whiff of some sickeningly sweet aftershave, tobacco, and burnt coffee. Not a single cubicle occupant raises his head as we move by. Their heads are down, poring over stacks of Excel charts and handwritten formulas, or staring blankly at computer screens. There must be 50 people in this windowless, airless room. Some of them, most of them, are young, barely out of college. I pause and peer into one of the cubicles, thinking I recognize Lynn's handwriting. Morgan snaps his fingers in front of my face.
Eyes ahead, Jean.
The aftershave, tobacco, and coffee mixture is hot on the back of my neck. Lorenzo's hand brushes against mine, lingering, reminding me I'm not alone in this. We pass through the bank of cubicles and reach the far end of the hive. Morgan inserts his keycard into another slot, and double doors open to a room not different from the rodent and rabbit den one floor above us. Here, instead of squeaking mice and sniffing cottontails, the cages house primates. Great apes, to be specific. Three rows of wire doors line the walls to my right and left, each labeled with an identification number and four rows of data. Age, species, date of experiment, overseeing technician. The hoots and grunts of chimpanzees as we enter are deafening. But this isn't what bothers me. Three quarters of the cages are empty. Labels remain on their doors. Bonobo, gorilla, orangutan. Three of the five great apes. The screeching chimpanzees make four, and half of them are already gone. I swallow dryly and look over at Lorenzo, who is pale enough to blend in with the lab's white walls. Of course he is. He's thinking the same thought I am. They're working their way through the apes, one species at a time, and they've saved the chimps, the closest human relative, for last. Or next to last. There's a fifth great ape, not in the cages, not yet, one they haven't gotten around to. All the blood in my veins chills to ice. The fifth species of great ape is us, human. My knees buckle, and I stumble to my left, hurtling into the cage of experiment number 412, a male chimpanzee that must outweigh me by 75 pounds. Lynn's repeated warnings sound in my head like a klaxon. Never, Jean, and I mean never, get close to them. We have techs and handlers for that. Don't feed them. Don't try to pet them. Don't even get within spitting distance of the cages. Stay in the middle. These guys have a reach of 3 feet, and believe me, they're not cute, Lynn said on our first tour of the lab, a few months after her grant funding came through and allowed us to purchase 2 chimps. They look cute, I said. Check that one out. Mason, a 4-foot-tall, diaper-clad male, was sucking on a popsicle in a nearby cage. Wait until he bears his canines, honey, Lynn said. These guys are time bombs with no set timer. A pro wrestler couldn't hold one still if he tried. You ever hear of Charla Nash? I shook my head. Do I want to? No. Tell you what, you think about that Hannibal Lecter dude. Think about what he did to that nice nurse when they forgot to put the weird hockey mask on him. Compared to a chimp, Lecter's harmless as a kitten under anesthesia, and you'll never know what hits you. What hits me now is a swat to the face and the bitter taste of iron on my lips. Part of my scalp, the part number 412 is pulling with the force of a monster truck in a redneck tractor pull contest, has been either set on fire or pierced with the ugly end of a pickaxe. My knees sing high C when bone meets tile as 2 opposing forces act on me, gravity drawing me down, the chimp trying to heave me up by my hair. Lorenzo's voice, faint and far away, calls out, "Do something for fuck's sake! Do something!" Is he talking to me? I reach up to the fire on my head, and a hand that's not a hand but a claw grabs it with a vice grip. Charla Nash, Charla Nash, Charla Nash, I think. The name screaming inside me, along with pictures of her missing eyes, her hands that looked as if they'd been fed into a meat grinder, the gash in her face where a mouth should be. A single shot buzzes in the air over my head, and I float down. 65. I'm not unconscious. If I were, I wouldn't feel fingers working their way through my tangled hair, putting out the fire of pain. I wouldn't be adding zoos and safaris and childhood fantasies of Jane Goodall to my list of things never to think about again. I wouldn't hear Morgan yelling like a petulant child who has just had his pacifier plucked from his mouth.
"What the hell did you do that for?"
he says. I open my eyes and see the soldier, gun hand still trembling after what might have been his first kill, looking from me to Lorenzo to Morgan to the dead number 412 in the cage above me. Before he can answer, Morgan opens his mouth again.
"That's just terrific. Just great. You idiot! I should put you in one of these cages, except you don't have enough of a brain for me to work with. Do you know how much these animals cost?"
"Apparently more than I do, Morgan," I say.
"Christ!"
He turns to Lorenzo.
"What's the damage?"
Lorenzo has unworked the chimp's fingers from my hair and lays me on the tiled floor as he inspects the gash on my face. A trickle of hot blood runs into my mouth.
"Does that hurt?"
he says, prodding at a spot near my temple. Hurt? No. It feels like I've been dragged across coarse sandpaper. It burns. "Yeah," I say, moving my hand up to the injury.
"No, you don't. I need to clean this. Morgan, get me a first aid kit."
"How am I supposed to know where they keep the first aid crap? I'm a project manager."
"You're a shit project manager, Morgan," Lorenzo says. "You're a lousy scientist and a poor researcher, and if I ever get you alone, I'm going to tear you apart one bone at a time. For now, start looking. Try the cabinet in the corner marked with a red cross."
Under his breath, he says, "Asshole." "Am I okay?" I say, wanting to touch my face, make sure everything is still where it's supposed to be.
"Better than okay,"
Lorenzo says.
"And Morgan, when you find that kit, call a doctor."
Morgan's shoes cross back until they're so close I can almost see my reflection in them.
"No can do. This is a secure facility, in case you missed that."
Lorenzo ignores him as he bathes the right side of my face with peroxide and fixes a clean bandage over the wound that runs from my hairline to the corner of my mouth.
"Surface scratches, mostly. Can you stand?"
"I think so." The lab, with its remaining chimps, comes into focus.
"What's going on, Morgan?"
I say. He's all business now, my near brush as the victim of a rogue primate forgotten.
"We need you back to work."
"Doing what? You said we were done. That hired thug called Poe said we were done. You scrubbed our files." I wait while Morgan studies his shoelaces.
"Follow me,"
he says. We leave the animal containment room and go through another set of doors. Inside, a replica of the basement lab hums with activity. No one, apparently, heard my screams, or the shot. Or maybe they did and don't care. It takes a few seconds before I see the gold emblems on their lab coats and the small gold squares on the key cards that hang around all the men's necks. Here, as in the cubicle-cramped room outside, everyone keeps his head down, and soldiers patrol the aisles.
"Welcome to the gold team,"
Morgan says, sounding more like a game show host than a scientist. No surprise, the man can't find a first aid kit when it's staring him in the face. He leads us to 4 square feet of unoccupied lab top and pauses, waiting for us to sit.
"Okay, Morgan, I'll bite," I say. "What the hell is this?"
"This is your new team."
He stretches an arm out. "And you can win all these prizes," I hear him say.
"I don't get it."
"You will."
Morgan nods to somewhere behind me. A man with bifocals as thick as glass brick appears and sets 2 thick binders on the counter in front of us, each one labeled "Top Secret" in gold lettering. Inside them are most of the data I had on my laptop. Before the bifocal man leaves, I catch another glint of gold on his left 4th finger. Morgan turns to the soldier who shot the chimp, with no time to spare, I think, and issues instructions I can't make out.
"Jana,"
Lorenzo says, nudging my elbow. He doesn't look at me. His eyes are roaming the lab. Then he taps the ring finger on his left hand. The stool I'm sitting on is one of those adjustable numbers with a lever below the seat. I reach down and raise it until I can see most of the lab. Men are scratching their heads, twirling mechanical pencils, rubbing tired eyes. Every left hand I can see has a gold wedding band on its 4th finger. And every pair of eyes holds fear.
"They're not volunteers, Enzo, are they?"
He shakes his head.
"Oh, Christ."
Every single man inside this complex is married, maybe has children.
"Some incentive," I say.
Morgan, now finished lecturing the poor soldier, who looks like he's seen his last paycheck, comes back to us.
"I need a formula, people. By tonight. By tomorrow morning, I need a working serum."
"We just gave you the working serum," I say. "And you have the vials, all 5 of them." I steel myself for the Jean routine that he does and grip the edge of the counter with both hands. Better to keep them gripping anything, since what they want to do right now is close around Morgan's neck. Tight. He smiles. You gave me a working series.